Writer and director Nora Ephron has died. She was best known for hugely successful romantic comedies and best-selling collections of essays. Ephron died last night in New York City after a struggle with leukemia. She was 71 years old. NPR's Netta Ulaby has this remembrance.
Nora Ephron brought us two of the most indelible scenes in contemporary cinema, and they're startlingly different. There's the infamous Silkwood Shower from the 1983 movie. When a terrified worker at a nuclear power plant gets exposed to radiation. Then there's the scene when Meg Ryan drives home a point to Billy Crystal at a deli in 1989's When Harry Met Sally.
Oh, yes! Yes! Yes!
I'll have what she's having.
Nora Ephron took romantic comedies to a new level. The heroines of When Harry Met Sally and Sleepless in Seattle were dreamers and strivers. They were women other women recognized. In 1998, Ephron talked with NPR on the set of her film You've Got Mail about being one of the few women in Hollywood to write, produce, and direct.
One of the things that I'm completely fascinated by is the determination of many film directors, mostly men, to believe that making a movie is like fighting a war. If you have a caterer along, it is not quite a war. I think we have to remember this.
Ephron's parents were screenwriters, but she started off in newspapers. She wrote such a dead-on parody of the New York Post, she was hired there soon after graduating from Wellesley. Her second marriage was to Washington Post reporter Carl Bernstein, but when it crumbled after his affair, she used it for fodder for the best-selling novel, Heartburn, that became a movie starring Meryl Streep.
Flowers, look at all these flowers that you bought her! And you occasionally brought me home a bunch of wilted zinnias. How can you do this?
But in real life, Nora Ephron remarried happily to the writer Nicholas Pileggi. She based her script for the movie My Blue Heaven on stories she heard from him when he was writing the book that became the movie Goodfellas. And the marriage in one of her last movies, Julie and Julia, also starring Meryl Streep, is a radiantly happy one.
What is it that you really like to do?
Eat.
I know. And we are so good at it. Look at you.
When she wasn't helming Oscar-nominated movies starring Meryl Streep or Meg Ryan, Ephron was writing essays about food, which she loved, her home in New York City, and growing old. Nora Ephron discussed aging in her book, I Feel Bad About My Neck, on NPR 6 years ago.
I think it's like a lot of things about getting older, is that you have absolutely no imagination that you're actually, this is actually going to happen to you. You sort of think for quite a while you're going to be the only person who doesn't need reading glasses or the only person who doesn't go through menopause. And in the end, the only person who isn't going to die. And then you suddenly are faced with whichever of those things it is. And you can't believe how unimaginative you have been.
But Nora Ephron's life was defined by imagination, freewheeling wit, and her ability to write her way into the world she wanted to live in and make them more welcoming places. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
Nora Ephron spoke to us on this program in 2010. She had just published her book, I Remember Nothing, and to maintain her memory and her sanity, she told us she had decided on a list of things she refused to learn anything more about.
The former Soviet republics, the Kardashians, Twitter, all housewives, survivors, American idols and bachelors, Karzai's brother, soccer, monkfish, Jay-Z, every drink invented since the Cosmopolitan, especially the drink made with crushed mint leaves. You know the one.
Right, the mojito. She also took a serious turn in that conversation, reflecting on getting older and mortality.
You do get to a certain point in life where you have to realistically, I think, understand that the days are getting shorter. And you can't put things off thinking you'll get to them someday. If you really want to do them, you better do them. There's simply too many people getting sick, and sooner or later you will. So I'm very much a believer in knowing what it is that you love doing so that you can do a great deal of it. You know, when my close friend died, you know, we always sit around and play the game, what would your last meal be? Mine happens to be a Nate and Al's hot dog. But Judy was dying of throat cancer, and she said, I can't even have my last meal. And that's what you have to know, is if you're serious about it, have it now. Have it tonight. Have it all the time, so that when you're lying on your deathbed, you're not thinking, oh, I should have had more Nate and Al's hot dogs.
Nora Ephron was 71 when she died yesterday in New York.
There's a lot to love about historical fiction, not just heaving bodices and poised lances. It's a genre that gives flesh, heart, and occasional humor to historical figures. It can be a good yarn that also makes you wonder how much of this is true long after you're done. Madeline Miller has written historical fiction, including The Song of Achilles, which won the Orange Prize for Fiction. She's recommending a short list of summer reading for those who might want to wander in the past. Madeline Miller joins us from the studios of Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's nice to be here.
I gather your love of historical fiction predates even when you started writing it.
Yes, it does. I mean, I love being immersed in another world where you're sort of learning all the details of what life was like for people in totally different cultures and different times.
And to your mind, how does historical fiction do this in a way that nonfiction, well, I don't want to say doesn't, but does in a different way?
In some sense, I think you have more freedom when you're doing historical fiction, because you can fully imagine a world that is likely, instead of kind of the readers constantly thinking, well, did that really happen? Did that really happen?
The Song of the Achilles is based on the Iliad, which is already a little apocryphal, if we can put it that way. Do you have a ratio you prefer of history to fiction?
I like a good mix of both. I was really looking for books that had kind of the perfect balance. I mean, I think it's fun to really dig in and learn all the cool little details about, for instance, you know, what types of poisons people used on their arrows.
Forgive me. You can't just say, and then he smeared some poison on the arrow.
Well, you could, but it's much more interesting to know where he got that poison, I think, and what it's going to do to you as opposed to the poison his neighbor might be using. But the best research is always invisible. You don't see the author hunched over their library books. You know, you really just completely enter the world.
You're recommending some recent releases that people might want to read this summer. Let's begin with Andrew Miller's noteworthy Pure.
It is a terrific book set in 1785 Paris, and it revolves around the cemetery and church Les Innocents, which was basically used as a mass grave site, and it had become pretty much a toxic dump. And Andrew Miller is brilliant about really bringing in the sights and the smells and the visceral sense.
In the church of Les Innocents, the light of a Paris morning falls in thin gray ropes from high windows, but does little to disturb the building's permanent twilight. Pillars, black or nearly so, rise like the remnants of a petrified forest, their tops lost in canopies of shadow.
Mm. And let me ask you about a book that's already gathered a lot of attention in France and won a number of awards, and that's Laurent Binet's, I don't know how to pronounce this, HH,
Yes. It's speaking of a memorable title, HHHH is apparently an acronym for a phrase, a kind of a play on words from German. And I'm going to butcher the pronunciation of this, but it's Himmler's Hirn heißt Heydrich, which means Himmler's brain is called Heydrich, and it's about the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich. So it's a fascinating novel, because the main character of the book is actually really a narrator kind of exploring how much he can reconstruct. And it's sort of funny because that makes it sound very intellectual and if it's not a page-turner, but the amazing thing is that he manages to do that and make it a complete page-turner.
Let me ask you finally about Richard Mason's History of a Pleasure Seeker. This is set in Europe at the turn of the century?
This is just such an enjoyable book. I mean, it's beautifully written, and its main character, who's Pete Burrell, is a extremely charming young man who is kind of has these rags-to-riches fantasies. He comes from a very, very modest background, but he manages to kind of talk and charm his way into a very rich household where he serves as a tutor. And it is very focused on sensual pleasures that are wonderfully described, particularly music.
Pete played the last bars of the nocturne very delicately, and the piano's ringing made the air between them tingle. He did not silence it by lifting his foot from the pedal. When Jacobina said, "Play me something more modern, Mr. Burrell," he was ready for her. His choice was the entr'acte to the third act of Carmen, also in E-flat major, which had been useful in similar situations before. Its pure, beguiling melody rose from the embers of the nocturne, and the rumbling arpeggios of the bass line showed his hands to advantage.
I gather he also, not that it's a how-to book, but it was a single piano key that's supposed to be the key to love?
That is right. Could be a good thing to know for the future. E-flat major is the key of love.
But only on the piano, not the kazoo?
I think piano would probably work better.
Madeline Miller is the author of The Song of Achilles, and you can see her full list of recommended historical fiction at NPR Books on NPR.org. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Imagine waking up to find that the Earth's rotation has slowed inexplicably, that the 24-hour day now has 56 extra minutes. And imagine what happens if the Earth turns more and more slowly for no reason until days last as long as weeks. That's the disturbing premise behind the new novel titled The Age of Miracles. And the effects of what becomes known as the slowing are calamitous. Birds fall from the sky, whales beach themselves, the oceans shift, and communities wash away. As gravity intensifies, people fall ill, magnetic fields decay, and radiation washes over the planet. Plants and animals die off. It's the vision of Karen Thompson Walker in her debut novel. The idea came when she read that the 2004 earthquake in Indonesia was so powerful that it accelerated the Earth's spin and shortened the day by a tiny fraction of a second.
When I read that, I was just stunned. I thought it was incredibly unsettling that that could happen, that something that I had always taken for granted, you know, the steady rising and setting of the sun every day, was actually subject to change. And I started to wonder right away what would happen to the planet and to us if there was a much larger change. So that's why in the book, the days grow by much more than a fraction of a second.
And Karen, you set up this fascinating tension between groups of people who stay on clock time, as the government has decided they should, clock timers, and real timers who try to set their rhythms to the rising and setting of the sun, which stretches out, it gets farther and farther apart.
Yeah, as soon as I started to paint this world where this was happening, I realized that because of the kind of chaos that would result from the days coming out of sync with the clocks, the government would have to do something to preserve some sort of order. And so what they do is impose the 24-hour clock. What that means, though, is that children are going to school sometimes in the dark. You know, 9 a.m. could land in the middle of a stretch of darkness, or noon might be happening at the same time as the sunset. Because it's so strange and unnatural, some people, a minority of people, the real-timers, they just can't accept that type of artificial life. And the real timers make the clock timers nervous. And the real timers, you know, they have to live outside of society as a result. And many of them begin to start these colonies, you know, in the deserts and the wildernesses where they can live just by the sunrise and the sunset.
Talk a bit about your process as you were thinking about, you know, what would happen if the Earth started to slow? Who did you talk to try to see, you know, is this real? Would this actually be the effect that there'd be a bird die-off and a plant die-off and gravity would intensify?
Well, I really wanted it to feel real, so I did a certain amount of scientific research. And I would lift details from newspaper stories often. You know, I think there's so many strange things happening in our real world. Like anytime there was a story about weird weather or new reports on climate change or extinction of species or the way that we use industrial greenhouses to grow crops that we couldn't otherwise grow. And then when I was finished and I had a complete draft, I worked up the nerve, I'd say, to show it to an astrophysicist. And that was a little scary. But I was relieved by how many of the consequences he felt were based in real science. And then he helped me make a few of them a little more realistic.
Karen, you're from Southern California. How important do you think it was for you to set the book there? Talk about that choice.
I definitely drew on the scenery, you know, the beaches and the cliffs and the eucalyptus trees and bougainvillea. But I do also think when you live in California, especially as a child, you're always half aware that a huge natural disaster, especially an earthquake, could happen at any moment. But really, you don't think about it very much. You know, you go on living pretty pleasant days. But I remember we used to, at the beginning of every school year, have to pack a Ziploc bag full of non-perishable foods, 3 days' supply. And that food would live in this plastic tub in the corner of the classroom, and that would be the food that if the big earthquake that everyone predicts will one day hit California, if that struck while we were at school and we were stranded, that's the food we would eat for 3 days. And of course, it never struck while I was there, but mm-hmm. that consciousness of disaster is part of living in California.
You know, reading this book is an unsettling experience. I mean, thinking about this apocalyptic vision in a way. And I wonder, as the writer, when you were working on this, if you would sort of wake up in the morning and be glad to see the sun had risen at the time you expected it to rise, did some of this sort of filter into your subconscious?
I don't know. I mean, I'm someone with a bit of a wild imagination for disaster, so I think just in my life. So I think, you know, I drew on that hobby or skill to write the book. But I do think there is something about apocalyptic stories as a writer and as a reader, where when you start to imagine all of ordinary life, all the things that we're used to falling away, it does, in a way that you might not expect, concentrate your attention on the kind of meaning and magic of all those small, ordinary things we take for granted every day.
Karen Thompson Walker, her book is The Age of Miracles. Karen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Pediatrician Harvey Karp has treated thousands of children over the course of his 30-year career. That includes the kids of celebrities like Madonna and Pierce Brosnan. And his popular series of parenting books, The Happiest Baby, are international bestsellers. His latest book is called The Happiest Baby Guide to Great Sleep. And if you're a parent, you know we're really talking about your sleep.
Well, it's the number one complaint parents have. And it isn't that they're being, you know, weak or wussy. I mean, the fact of the matter is, the military uses sleep deprivation to train Navy SEALs to endure torture because it's one of the main triggers for postpartum depression. You get more illnesses. Your immune system is knocked down. Of course, you're irritable and you have more marital stress when that happens. So it has a lot of burden on families beyond the fact that you're tired.
You are best known. Anybody listening to this who has had a child in the last 5 years knows who Harvey Karp is because you probably received one or two, or in my case, five copies of his DVD from friends of mine. The Happiest Baby on the Block, which is basically a method to quiet your kid. The five S's, this is what you're famous for. So for people who don't know what those are, tell me what the five S's are.
So it turns out calming a crying baby is oftentimes as simple as turning on their calming reflex. That's a reflex all babies are born with. That's a kind of an off switch for crying and an on switch for sleep. And the way you turn that on is by doing these five steps that imitate the womb. It's swaddling, which is snug wrapping. The side or stomach position, never for sleep. The back is the only position for sleep, but it's the worst position for a crying baby. The third is shushing or white noise. The fourth is swinging or rhythmic motion. And the fifth is sucking. And every kid's a little bit different, but you layer those on. And in the first 3 or 4 months of life, those are like a magic, you know, potion for them.
Do you know how many times I was crouched over with my child on his side going, shh, at 2 a.m? And it's strange because you actually, the way I did it was not as loud as you suggest. You suggested you do it quite loud.
Well, you do it as loud as they're crying, really.
Yeah.
And the sound in the womb is louder than a vacuum cleaner 24/7.
The idea that you have is that when a baby is born, they enter the fourth trimester.
Right. So in other words, our babies aren't like horses. They can't run the first day of life. They're very immature. It's amazing. By 3 months of age, they're ready to do the most important thing a human being ever does, which is develop social relations. You smile, they smile. You coo, they coo. But they can't do that in the first couple of months. And so we need to recognize that they're evicted from the womb 3 months before they're ready for the world. So even if you hold them 12 hours a day, that's a big cutback from the 24 hours a day they were used to. And this noise thing is an important part of it too, because in the womb, the sound is loud. And so to put them in a quiet room and tiptoe around seems like that's a right idea. Actually, it's sensory deprivation. It drives them crazy. It's a wonder that any of them sleep in a quiet room. And so one of the things that can be a help is to use white noise, because what happens is that you think while you're sleeping. The white noise literally competes with your thinking. It certainly competes with other sounds on the street, trucks and planes and things like that that can disturb you. But it even competes with your own thinking. So it helps kids and adults, for that matter, be able to stay in a better level of sleep.
Let's talk about some myths that you want to dispel. One of the myths is never wake a sleeping baby.
Right.
Why would you want to wake a sleeping baby?
Well, the fact of the matter is that one of the things we have to teach babies is how to be able to put themselves to sleep on their own. What you're hoping is that when your little baby wakes up at 3 a.m, if they're not hungry or they're not in pain or something, they have the capability of putting themselves back to sleep. If you always rock and feed your baby until they're in this blissful state, and then you gently put them into the bed, then they've never learned that ability. So there's a technique called wake sleep where you feed your baby. Don't worry if your baby falls asleep in your arms. That's fine. But when you do put the baby in bed, and they're drunk from the milk anyway at that point, you kind of slide them in bed, swaddled, with the white noise playing, and you literally wake them up. They look around for 5 or 10 seconds and fall asleep. And in those 10 seconds, they're learning how to self-soothe.
How has early childhood parenting changed over the course even of your career, you know, let's say over the last 20 or so years in the United States, dramatically?
We've kind of gone through a cycle where parents have gotten very good at doing well in school, doing well in the workplace, and having these more mature kind of methods for dealing with people. Unfortunately, when you take those business methods to work with a toddler, it can lead to conflicts. And so I think that one of the big changes that's occurred is that parents have lost their way in terms of being able to have good relationships with their young kids and have kind of an intuitive approach to how they should speak and what they should expect. What I talk a lot about is how you need to speak to your child in kind of a different language. That toddlers, in an odd sort of a way, are like cavemen. They're uncivilized. Mm. Matter of fact, your job, and you know this, you've got two kids. Mm. A 9-month-old is not born knowing how to say please and thank you and wait in line and share their toys. Mm-hmm. We have to teach that to our toddlers. But what is one of the biggest mistakes parents make is when their toddler is upset, we tend to speak to them almost like we're like mini psychiatrists.
Right.
The more upset they get, we go, sweetheart, it's okay. It's okay. Calm down. Calm down. Calm down. Like we're talking off out of jumping off a bridge or something. And what that feels like when you're very upset is it feels patronizing.
Yes.
Like you don't really understand how I feel. You're just trying to make me stop talking. And so with a very simple change in technique where you use short phrases, repetition, and mirroring a third of their feeling, I call it toddlerese. Hmm. So when your child is upset, it might be something like, you don't like it. You say, no, no, no. You don't want to do that. Your face is sad and you don't want to go with mommy right now. And what happens is they start to calm down because they feel acknowledged. And then you say, but honey, we have to go. Daddy's waiting. You know, and then you get to your message. And this isn't magic. It doesn't work 100% of the time. But probably 50% of the time, you can stop a young child's temper tantrums as young as a year of age, because what they're trying to do is just get you to understand what it is they're feeling. And they just want to be acknowledged.
What do you think is the biggest misconception you hear about parenting? Like, what do people think parenting is, maybe before they have a kid or if they don't have a kid, that is just not true?
Well, the biggest misconception, I think, is that you're going to have control in the situation. Mm. We're so used to having control in our lives. And even being pregnant, you kind of have control. You can make choices and do the things you want to do. Once you have a child, suddenly that control is taken away from you. And that's a real shocker for people with young children. You ultimately have to make the decisions, obviously. You're the last resort.
Yeah.
But young children do need respect, and they do need some opportunities to make decisions so that they can grow up and learn how to do that. This idea that you've got all the answers, all the control, you know, that's something that I think is a shock for parents.
That's a renowned pediatrician, Dr. Harvey Karp. He's a fellow at the American Academy of Pediatrics. His new book is called The Happiest Baby Guide to Great Sleep. You could also call it The Happiest Parent Guide to Great Sleep.
Well, hopefully the whole family.
Dr. Karp, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Guy.
Now the latest entry in our series for young teens, PG-13, and we're talking about books, not movies. It's during these early adolescent years that young readers really start to crave adult ideas. When author Meg Wolitzer was at that age, she discovered a book about mental illness, one that really transformed her thinking. The book is called Lisa, Bright and Dark.
You know how people talk about gateway drugs? The ones that aren't so bad, but that lead you to harder ones? I think some books are like that. Reading them pushes you toward other books that are similar but more intense. Lisa Bright and Dark was that for me. It's a young adult novel from 1969, and it was written by John Neufeld. I read it when I was 13, and I credit it with leading me to The Bell Jar a few years later, which was an essential book in my life. Lisa Bright and Dark was like The Bell Jar's little sister. It's easier to read, less literary, and slightly less harrowing. But it's the same kind of look at mental illness. The thing is, when you're a teenager and you read about girls who fall apart, you definitely start to wonder if the same thing might happen to you. Lisa Bright and Dark is about a group of kids who are all worried about their friend Lisa Schilling. She has her bright days when she's fun to be around, and her dark days when she does and says things that don't make sense. The friends try desperately to get adults to notice and help Lisa, but nobody seems to care. Lisa gets more and more unhinged, and finally, towards the end of the book, she walks through a pane of glass. I never forgot that glass. I worried that I also might go mad and do something equally shocking. I think the fear of losing your mind is a pretty common one for teenagers. But for me, who is not mentally ill, and who at age 13 was just trying to figure out what an inner life was all about, Lisa Bright and Dark was a gateway, no, a doorway, with its own gleaming pane of glass that I was very relieved never to walk through.
Author Meg Wolitzer, her most recent book, The Fingertips of Duncan Dorfman, is for young readers. She recommended Lisa Bright and Dark by John Neufeld, which led her to Sylvia Plath's book, The Bell Jar. You can find more PG-13 reading recommendations at our website. There's also a list of summer reads from our critics and correspondents. That's at nprbooks.org.